This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
State violence is always worse. We give a lot of power to the state to police us, the power to kill. And if they abuse that power, that's worse than one of us on the street doing something that we're not supposed to do, breaking the law, property crime.
In his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, James Lowen writes that race is the sharpest and deepest division in American life. We recognize the peaceful protests that have emerged in the wake of the murder of George Floyd as a force for healing and for addressing our nation's shameful history surrounding race. Millions of Americans of all ages, races, ethnicities, and identities are taking to the streets to support the Black Lives Matter movement. It appears that white America is finally waking up and acknowledging that being not racist won't undo the pervasive racism in our collective psyche. Rather, we must be actively anti-racist. This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome Castle Redmond, a senior program manager from the California Endowment, to discuss why this moment feels different. He helps put the images of looting we're seeing on our TV screens into historical context, and we look at the places where the environmental and racial justice movements intersect. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend, Castle Redmond. Castle, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Our listeners may recognize Castle's voice for some of the voiceover work he's done in the past. We've been friends for about 20 years, but I wanted to have you on today to talk about what's happening in America since the George Floyd murder. First, why don't you tell us a little bit about your current position and how it's relevant to this discussion about race.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Alex. Despite some of the craziness going on and in the world right now, there are rays of incredible hope. And I'm very inspired by what's going on in the streets right now. My name is Castle Redmond. I work for the California Endowment. We're a health foundation. We are the largest state-focused foundation in the country. I oversee our statewide Boys and Men of Color portfolio. So our mission is to improve the health of Californians and to increase access to healthcare for all Californians. And that really, to do that, we have to focus very heavily on those whose outcomes are the poorest. Folks who have had the least access to healthcare and whose health outcomes are at the bottom. And we found that those run along racial lines. And it's the same racial lines that were there when this racial hierarchy was created at our founding, at really in 1619, when the first slaves were brought and when we began to take land from the Native folks here.
And before the California Endowment, what did you do?
Before the California Endowment, I ran juvenile reentry. I started the first juvenile reentry program in Oakland, California. So I oversaw making sure that every young person coming out of juvenile hall with an Oakland address was enrolled in school within 3 days and had a case manager assigned to them to help them get through.
Before we go to the rays of hope that we're seeing, let's talk about some of the shards or the shattered glass of anger that most of us feel when we see something like the brutal murder on camera of George Floyd. Why do you think this moment was different in some ways?
For two reasons. I think number one, it's this has been building over time, especially since Ferguson. And community organizers have been working on racial justice issues more collaboratively since then. Black Lives Matter has really been those folks, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, have done an incredible amount of work with many, many other organizers to get ready for this moment. That's number one. Number two is, that was the worst video I think any of us have ever seen. That was a public execution over 9 minutes that we had to watch on film, and it was conducted by the state. It was the police who were supposed to protect us who did that. And it was a horrible, horrible thing to watch. And I think that woke a lot of people up. And we talk about being woke. It's a being awake to that reality, that thing that happens, that they happened on camera while they knew they were being filmed and still did it.
And it wasn't just a one guy acting.
It was three others who stood by and watched, other law enforcement officers. And this person right here with, 20 complaints against him already, was a training officer. He was a man. They put him in a place of authority. That's how the system. That's how off the system and the culture have gotten. It's not about one person, and it's not about police officers are evil or they're all bad or they're all racist. It's not about an individual. But we have to really look at the whole system. That's why they call it systemic racism.
And it's not just police either. It comes from the top down. I mean, we have a racist in the White House, but we also have a whole movement of white supremacy that we haven't really seen since Jim Crow America.
Yeah, since Jim Crow. I mean, my father grew up in the Jim Crow South. You know, he's a sharecropper.
Yeah, why don't we, before we dive more into the present, why don't you tell us a little bit more about growing up in a black and white household in the East Bay?
Yeah, so my mother's Jewish. She's white and Jewish, and my father's black. My father's from North Carolina, Tarboro, North Carolina, and my grandfather, Jake, they were sharecroppers and before they moved into town. So my father was born on a sharecropping farm that had, I mean, prior to that, it had been a plantation, right? So they grew up picking cotton and tobacco. You know, it's very similar to being undocumented and working the fields here in California. And so that legacy, we're still exploiting and demonizing people today in very similar ways to the way we did it then, although we try to pretend that it's different. So it's something that we have to really take a hard look at and really look in the mirror. And I think that's what people are finally doing right now.
You told me once when we were talking about race in a offhand way, I forgot. You were saying it doesn't matter if your mom's white and your dad's black, you're black.
Yeah. I'm black. I'm not half anything. I'm black. I mean, that's America though. That's the way it's always been in America. So, I mean, when we had a segregated baseball, for instance, if you looked out to other countries to find out, if you went to Cuba to find a baseball player, the question they asked was, you know, was there any black blood? If there's any black blood in you, then you play in the Negro Leagues, right? So that's the legacy of our entire country, one drop rule. And so that certainly applied to me and my upbringing. Wasn't something my parents had to instill in me. It's what, America instilled. That's what it told me.
And explain what redlining is and what your folks had to do to buy a house in Castro Valley back in the late 60s, early 70s, was it?
In the 70s, yeah. It was in the 70s when I was a kid. We moved from South Hayward, which was a mixed neighborhood, but it was a neighborhood that black people could live in, to Castro Valley, where the town my mother was from, actually. And the real estate agent, you know, told my parents that they didn't sell to black people in that neighborhood. And so this is on the just after the civil rights movement, really. So it's in the 70s, and so that was the era, you know, like with the play A Raisin in the Sun, where we weren't allowing folks to tell us where we could and couldn't move. So you did whatever you could to integrate, essentially. So my mother went and got my grandmother, and the two of them bought the house, and then we moved in. Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
So that was the dulcet tones of Castle Redmond doing his Sea Change Radio spot back, I don't know, 10 years ago for our listeners. I'm speaking now live with Castle Redmond, who's a program manager at the California Endowment. So Castle, you mentioned how this all goes back to 1619, and I think that's an important jumping off point for any kind of debate about what we're seeing right now in terms of the backlash from not only the George Floyd murder, but the backlash against the protests against it, the right-wing talking point that, you know, the looting and the violence is much worse than what the police had perpetrated. Obviously, when we see video of some kids, black, white, doesn't matter, smashing windows and grabbing radios or whatever from a window, it makes us think that that's not productive. But maybe you can kind of put that anger into a little bit more historical context for us.
Yeah, I mean, no one wants that. No one likes to see that. And yet we have to understand that's always been part of it. And our country was founded on that, on those kinds of uprisings, on really riots. You know, the Tea Party was a riot and involved looting. The Boston Massacre was a riot. And it was conducted by people who called themselves patriots and sons of liberty, and they're remembered as heroes, the founders of our country. And what they really did was they got drunk and they went and started to harass the law enforcement of the day, which was a British soldier, because they were angry at a corrupt leader, a corrupt king. And they ended up rioting and looting and getting shot.
Because they were breaking the law.
Because they were breaking the law at the time. And they had conflict with police at the time, which were British soldiers. So this is always, it's part of all uprisings like this. They were looting.
So what would you say to somebody who thinks that the looting is worse than the status quo?
They're not paying attention because, first of all, the protests out there right now, folks, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the street daily, weekly, without that right now. So that's actually a small part of what was going on that got a lot of news coverage, number one. And number two, state violence is always worse. We give a lot of power to the state to police us, the power to kill. And if they abuse that power, that's worse than one of us on the street doing something that we're not supposed to do, breaking the law, property crime. And then lastly is that looting has always been part of uprisings, including those done by our founding fathers that created this nation, the people we consider to be heroes. They looted.
Just carrying on the tradition.
Carrying on the American way.
So you're intimately involved in education at all different levels. What are some of the ways that our various systems like education perpetuate inequity, and how do we help undo this?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, we have to look at all the systems. You know, they say that, you know, the impact of segregation, if we statistically eliminated segregation in America, we would eliminate all the inequitable outcomes in education, in health, in the justice system, and income and wealth. And so we have to understand that the roots of all of this were created by the laws that we implemented. And so when you have inequitable outcomes in education, suspension rates, high school graduation rates that run along those same racial lines that we segregated, demonized, and disinvested, then you're going to get outcomes that manifest themselves in all kinds of ways. And one of the most important ways is a disconnection from the American dream. I mean, James Baldwin said it well when we talked about the American dream and Black America. And if we have no connection to the American dream, then what's the point of going to school? What's the point of school at all? America itself has to kind of reckon with itself and determine what is America's relationship to Black people.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Castle Redmond. He's a senior program manager for the California Endowment. So, Castle, last week we had my friend Maurice Plains, a high school buddy of mine, who I asked him, how do you view police today as you did when we were in high school, when he gave an anecdote about being harassed? And he said, very much the same. He trusts the police about as much as he did growing up. He was first arrested when he was 8 years old in Brooklyn. What do you think your dad would say if we asked him to compare the police from the 50s and 60s, both in North Carolina and out here in Oakland, to police today? I mean, he's an older man now, so he probably doesn't have the same kind of interaction with law enforcement as he did when he was in his teens and 20s, but have you talked to him about this? I'd love to hear Willie's perspective.
Yeah, I have, and I do. I mean, first I want to say that I have friends who are police officers and former police officers and good people, and this is not it's not an anti-individual cop kind of thing, and I don't view police in a way of hating the individuals in uniform or even hating the institution itself. But my experience with the police I never felt that they were here to protect me. In other words, I just inherently kind of in my gut don't feel protected by the police. It's a tricky one. And so for my father, you know, when I was a kid, my biggest fear in life was that my dad was gonna get killed by the police.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a fear that most white kids have growing up.
I hope not.
That's a big demarcation line, I think, though, in terms of growing up Black in America.
Yeah. I mean, my experience with the police, even when I was a kid, was that the police
were not there to help you necessarily.
When I was a kid, the police give you crap, and my dad didn't take crap off of people. So that math equation didn't work in my father's favor. Mm-hmm. It just in my gut, I was afraid of that. Mm-hmm. And it's not that different now. The only thing I will say that is different now is that, and I still get, you know, I still have these bad interactions with police because of the way they approach me. They don't have to do that. They don't have to come at me like that. It's difficult. It's difficult when it doesn't have to be. And it has to be a culture thing inside the departments, inside the institution itself. And I'd like to see that change. And what I will say is that police are having to reckon with that now, to be able to exist and operate now. And so that reckoning is going to hopefully make things better. We can't do tinker around the edges reform. We have to really take a look at the core of how police view themselves, who do they recruit, and what is their mission. I mean, you have to take a really hard, deep look and determine whether or not we want a system of public safety that is grounded in this kind of force, or do we need something different? Does the institution need to kind of really, really transform from the inside?
I crossed the empty streets, caught the Sunday smell of someone frying chicken. And it took me back to something that I lost somewhere, somehow along the way. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was strong. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. There ain't nothing short of dying half as lonesome as the sound of off a sleeping city sidewalk. Sunday morning coming down.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Castle Redmond. He is a senior program manager at the California Endowment. Yes, you hear to protect and to serve is kind of the national mission of law enforcement in this country. So many police departments have that written and right there on their police cars, but I think far too often law enforcement loses sight of who they're actually serving. They're not serving all of us. You know, they may be trying to protect some of us. When somebody is killing somebody over a counterfeit bill, like $20 George Floyd, a $20 bill, he's lost sight of the mission statement of his organization by a long shot. He's not protecting.
Maybe
he
never should have been there in the first place. Maybe he's the wrong guy, right? The wrong people. And they have a lot of the wrong people.
But it's a tough job, and you can see how people become so jaded. There's some great communities here in the East Bay, like Richmond, which has done some very progressive work in trying to change the culture of their law enforcement.
Yeah, I know in Richmond, the Rise Center in Richmond has done incredible work there, and I know they've been working with the police department. I know that Advanced Peace, which is now statewide and national, began in Richmond out of the Office of Neighborhood Safety, that has worked directly with young men who are most likely to be shot or to shoot someone, and have had incredible results doing that kind of work. And so there are really ways to keep the public safe that are grounded in prevention, that are grounded in healing, that are grounded in youth development, you know, really working to keep folks, young people, out of the system, right? That includes interactions with law enforcement. Police officers themselves are asked to do things that they should not be asked to do. I actually think, you know, law enforcement, they should have social work backgrounds, not criminal justice backgrounds. And at the same time, there are so many things that can be done by community-based organizations that have to do, especially around mental health, you know, when officers should be called. I mean, they shouldn't be on school campuses. There are a lot of things we can do to limit interactions with police where this kind of stuff is going to happen. But I will say that who we recruit to become police officers and who we let in, who we let stay, has to be reexamined.
We're obviously focusing far too much on worst outcomes as opposed to, like, in the Koban system in Japan. This is a country with one of the lowest crime rates in the world. Police officers very rarely carry guns, and they're usually on foot. The Koban means a police box. So it's like they just have tons of these boxes, and these policemen kind of do the old-fashioned walking their beat, and they know the community. I mean, it can lead to racial profiling and other nastiness, but it also can lead to, I think, everybody feeling like they're part of this social contract, maybe more than we have here.
Yeah, I mean, that's critical overall. I agree with that. And there's a question about what we want police to do and what we want police not to do. They shouldn't have to deal with every societal issue that comes up, mental health being one of them, mental illness being one of them, right? I mean, we need other interventions so the police don't have to deal with that. And the police can deal with what they're supposed to, and they should see their mission a little differently, I think, probably as well.
Speaking of Richmond, California, I couldn't help but think of the Chevron refinery there. And when you consider how communities of color disproportionately bear climate impacts, from something like in Richmond to storms and heat waves to pollution, the environmental movement is very white generally, and the racial justice movement is more diverse. You know, climate solutions like the promise of green jobs could certainly ultimately help people of color economically, but in your estimation, how do we get those movements to better intersect, the racial justice movement and the environmental movement?
Well, it is in some ways. I mean, there are a greenlining institute. I think there are a growing number of organizations that are really grounded in racial justice that are taking on environmental issues. And I think that's the way to do it. I mean, I think the way to do it is that the environmental movement has to decide whether it's a racial justice movement or not. Can't ignore it. Nobody can ignore that now. And if they decide that, then they'll be able to make those connections with those organizations grounded in racial justice that are also taking on that are taking on environmental justice issues. And that's where you can get a really powerful environmental justice movement.
I mean, you see that with the success of the Keystone XL pipeline with the Native American movement there, the indigenous people in those states that rose up to make their voices heard. That was an important intersection.
That's right. And that should be, that should be accelerated. The environmental movement should be, you know, deeply engaged in with Native peoples around environmental justice. That's how racial justice and environmental justice can come together. But I think it's going to be incumbent on the environmental movement to do that. Not the other way around. It's not on Native folks to reach out to the environmental movement. That wouldn't make any sense. It's got to be the other way around.
Especially when you consider where the donations come from and the deeper pockets of all these big green nonprofits. They're very well funded ultimately compared to some of the smaller nonprofits that focus on racial justice solely.
Yeah, and when you talk about racial privilege and white privilege and that kind of thing, you know, we have an obligation in a country to right some of these wrongs. And so what that means there is that they have to look at what are those issues that matter to the Native community in their region or their state or the country and talk about those issues, not tell Native folks that they should worry about whatever issue, climate change or whatever other issue that is hot for the Sierra Club or someone else. You got to go listen and learn and build relationships and talk about what is important to those Native communities.
He's a program manager for the California Endowment, Castle Redmond. Castle, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Dire Straits, Sly and the Family Stone, and Chris Christopherson and Johnny Cash.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.